It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. After at least four communities signed non-disclosure agreements, or NDAs, as part of creating billions of dollars worth of data center projects, lawmakers are debating whether to ban those agreements.
Seven major data center projects are underway in Wisconsin, totaling more than $57 billion. Four of those projects were kept under wraps through confidential non-disclosure agreements, including ones in DeForest and Beaver Dam. That's according to reporting from Wisconsin Watch.
A proposal in the state legislature would bar data center developers from entering into these types of agreements to keep key info confidential and would prevent local governments from approving a data center development project if an NDA is used.
This comes as an advocacy group in Port Washington fell short of recalling the city's mayor earlier this week after organizers say the mayor failed to properly inform the public about a nearby $15 billion AI data center project.
Two sponsors of the legislation join us now. Andre Jacques is a Republican state senator from Senate District 1. That includes areas east of Appleton and Green Bay, all of Door and Kewaunee counties. Senator Jacques, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning.
And Representative,
program.
And Representative Clint Moses is here, Republican in the Assembly from the 92nd District. That includes Menominee and Chippewa Falls. Representative Moses, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you.
Senator Jacques, let's start with you. What is the need for this legislation?
Yeah, you know, this is really, I think, something that we've seen across the country where there's just mistrust that is sown when you have, whether they're gag orders or just efforts to keep information out of the public domain, and in some cases, just keep information away from the local communities, that the actual public officials that are going to have to make decisions on things that really are going to shape the future of the community if those projects are going to go forward. So, you know, this is something that has happened in my area, something that I just think it's critical that we have transparency and, you know, really be upfront with folks.
Representative Moses, what are the basics? How would this bill work?
Yeah, and, you know, it came up, obviously, because I had a similar situation in my district, in my hometown of Menominee, up there between Eau Claire and Hudson, where the district city administrator was asked to sign a non-disclosure agreement roughly a year prior to the public finding anything out. So basically, by having this in place, it makes sure that the public gets all the information so they can decide if the data center is a good fit or maybe not for them, looking at infrastructure costs, environmental issues that might arise, economic impact, those types of things. And if they don't follow what's in the bill, if they try to enact a non-disclosure and they're not transparent, it basically null and voids the whole deal, so they're not able to put one of these data centers in a community.
This whole data center thing kind of came out of nowhere, 0 to 60 really fast. You've both mentioned this is an issue in your district. Senator Jacques, starting with you, what are you hearing from your constituents around data centers, especially when it comes to that this kind of transparency issue you're addressing?
You know, I think it's really unanimous across my district that this is something that folks want. And I mean, you have neighbors that in some cases are being played against each other. I think you have pressure tactics that are being used in just various communities and tearing communities apart. And, you know, this was something that I looked around at what other protections have been proposed elsewhere and saw some good model language for how we could do this in Wisconsin. And yeah, I mean, I think it's just critical that you are making sure that you're not having these secret deals. And if you are, the project can't move forward.
And Representative Moses, you're on the opposite side of the state from Senator Jacques. Are you hearing similar things from your constituents?
Oh, most definitely. You know, it is happening all over the state. And I will say, just like I said in the testimony, the Senate had a testimony on this, obviously, a couple days ago, which the way session is right now, that seems like 2 weeks ago. But, you know, I mentioned in the testimony, this is, I would estimate, an 85, maybe even a 90-10 issue. And it doesn't matter what walk of life, what political affiliation you might have, because I have people on the far right and on the far left that are very much interested in data centers and for the most part against having them in a community, especially if they don't have the information to make a good judgment call on it. But I also will say it has kind of unified some of our community because I have never in my community seen so many people of different views get behind something. I mean, we have a social media page that within like a month of its formation it had around 10,000 followers on it, on the Stop the Menominee Data Center.
Senator Jacques, industry groups, the Wisconsin Data Center Coalition and Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, have registered in opposition to your legislation here. They say, hey, this is going to hurt Wisconsin's competitive edge. And you could see that, right? If I want to open a data center, I'm in a competitive business. I don't want to give 10 months, 12 months lead time to my competitors about what my plans are. If a state like Wisconsin has this kind of legislation, I might say, that's fine for you. I'm going to take my business and my those construction jobs elsewhere. What do you say to those concerns?
I just think that this is too important a decision to get wrong for our communities. Major infrastructure decisions should be able to withstand some public scrutiny. So, I mean, if it's something that's going to be good for the community, there should be some daylight. And if your strategy is to say you can't talk about something that you're saying is a great opportunity, you know, that's not a development strategy. It's a gag order. And I think, you know, we're still allowing for protection of trade secrets. But, if it's competitive between other states, sure, let people know that there are other sites that are being considered. But let's not avoid all of the very significant dimensions, whether it's environmental issues, utility rates, emergency services, roads and other infrastructure. I think it's just critical that that be part of the conversation.
Representative Moses, still pretending I'm a data center developer here. If I'm looking at doing business in Menominee, say, and I want a non-disclosure agreement, I can't have it under this law. Somebody else wants to open a widget factory in 12 months. This legislation specifies data center. They could theoretically have an NDA. I couldn't. Is that fair business-wise? Could it open it up to legal challenges if you're discriminating against this kind of business and not that one?
You know, I really don't think so. And I will tell you, the senator kind of touched on this too, but this is too big a deal, too important to weigh in on looking at all the environmental issues. And like I said, the infrastructure costs and the energy costs potentially with it. And traditionally, you know, when we've had developments, they bring in a lot of jobs. You know, I have a number of large manufacturers in my district, right in Menominee there, that have, yeah, they've gotten tax incentives to come into the community, but they've also provided hundreds, if not thousands, of jobs to our community. That information is still out there on these data centers. We don't know what they're going to produce. And I really think, you know, it's something the public needs to be able to weigh in on. And even your local government, you know, they need to hear from constituents, our city councils, our mayors. They need to hear what's out there, you know. Myself and the senator deal with this all the time. We are constantly listening to constituents because we need to know what the opinion is of the people that we represent. So how do we do that if our constituents don't know what's going on?
We're talking about a bill that would bar the use of non-disclosure agreements for data center projects in Wisconsin. Two authors with us, Representative Clint Moses, Senator Andre Jacques from Northwest and Northeast Wisconsin, respectively. Let's talk about the prospects and timeline here. And Representative Moses, I want to start with you, the Assembly, looking to close up business for the session pretty soon. We know you don't get a vote in the Assembly without support from leadership. Do you think it's going to happen in this session?
Unfortunately, I would tell you no. I've sent in two requests. You know, obviously, this stuff came up really quick. I wanted to get something done and obviously get it across the finish line, but we introduced this bill not too long ago. I have sent out two letters to leadership to at least get it referred to a committee. Now, I will say I asked for it to get referred to State Affairs. State Affairs is actually meeting next week, but if things go well this week and today and tomorrow, we should be wrapped up with the Assembly floor periods for the session. Unless something extraordinary happens, we end up back here in March. But at least we've got some movement on it, and maybe we can tack it onto a bill here at the end. We'll see.
And Representative Moses, we woke up to some surprising news from your chamber with the postpartum health care legislation getting a vote. This has been an issue for a long time. Is there room for, I won't say a miracle, but is there room for a big shift that could bring something to a vote faster on this?
Certainly there is. If there's enough pressure from within the caucus and inside the building, both of those bills, obviously, I was pretty front and center on those. I've supported those from day one. Obviously, chair is the Health, Aging, Long-Term Care Committee. So, yeah, we had a press conference in the late hours last night, and people are pretty excited about those two bills as well. So I figured you'd mention them this morning.
Senator Jacques, on your side of the on your chamber, do you think this one's going to come to a vote? You've got a little more time on your session, as I understand it.
Yeah, you know, I really appreciate the Chairman Bradley bringing this forward to a hearing promptly within the Senate. It has, I think, quite a bit of support within my caucus. again, I think with the public at large. So I do see this as something moving forward. And, you know, honestly, as we look at, you know, whether it's any legislation that's involved data centers or things that have already been sent over from the assembly, if they'd like to see those become law, the Senate has the ability to make amendments. And, I honestly don't think that work should be done for this session yet. So I think the Senate's going to still have a say in what goes to the assembly.
There's some diplomacy involved. Senator Jacques, do you and your Senate colleagues supporting this bill see a way to diplomatically apply pressure to Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who is ultimately going to say, hey, this goes to committee, this goes to a vote? Are you trying to have a line of communication with him on this bill?
I'll just say there's discussions ongoing on a whole host of issues. And, you know, I think things are still fluid at this point, but certainly hard lines change, as I think we just saw in the assembly. So, this is the time of the art of the possible, and we'll see what pathways there are forward.
Briefly, before we wrap up, Senator Jacques, do you see data centers having a positive role in Wisconsin's economy with the right safeguards in place?
You know, I think there are certainly places where it makes a lot more sense than others to locate a data center. And I don't think anybody could really argue with that when you look at places where land could be repurposed. But the reality is that these are massive structures. The scope is beyond just about any other development that you could be talking about. So, you know, again, it is really important that we get this right. And when communities are going to have to ultimately have to rezone land anyways to be able to allow for these developments, I think it just makes sense that that information should be out to the public and to local communities as soon as possible.
We'll leave it there. Senator Jacques, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Representative Moses, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good day.
That's Andre Jacques, Republican State Senator from Northeast Wisconsin. Representative Clint Moses, Republican Representative from Northwestern Wisconsin. They are authors of a new bill that would restrict non-disclosure agreements for data center development in local communities around Wisconsin.
Coming up, Madison Area Technical College opens a $10 million early learning campus, expanding its childcare offerings. Hear about the impact.
By supporting those children, we're also supporting those families so that they can concentrate on their schooling.
And UW La Crosse marks 40 years of its campus child center. That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The American Council on Education says roughly 18% of undergraduate students are parents. At Madison Area Technical College, that number's closer to 42% of students.
The challenges of parenting while also pursuing a college degree can make childcare an essential part of achieving that goal.
Some of Wisconsin's universities and technical colleges are trying to meet that need by offering childcare on campus. Madison College recently opened a $10 million early learning campus, and it's expanding its childcare and educational training.
At UW La Crosse, its campus child center is marking 40 years of service to its student body and the community. To look at the impact of these centers, we have Donna Jost, campus childcare administrator for Madison College. Donna, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And Ashley Franzo directs the Campus Child Center at UW La Crosse. Ashley, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Donna, I want to start with you. Your $10 million early learning campus at your Goodman South campus, it opened last month. What are you now able to offer your students?
This is the college's second early learning campus, and this one is located at our second largest campus. That's going to give a lot more access to our student parents in the college. And also, we are now side by side with the early childhood education academic program. So it'll be a lot easier for us to be able to work together for things like practicum or field experiences, observations that are specific for the early childhood students and also to employ as student staff in the center those early childhood students as well.
And the child care center, it's just been open for weeks now, but what is enrollment like? How is the center being received?
The center is being very well received. In fact, just this morning, I had a group of 14 different Madison College retirees coming and touring the center. So not only current staff and faculty, but also former staff and faculty are pretty excited about this. This has been over 10 years in the planning, and so everyone is excited about it. Because we opened mid-year enrollment, we did not start really enrolling families until this past month because I needed to make sure that construction was actually complete and we had it fully licensed before I had families start giving up their other existing childcare to join us.
That is such an important transition, especially for families. Ashley, UW-La Crosse's Campus Child Center, it's been such a fixture on your campus for 40 years. What stands out to you about its impact on your campus community?
Sure, we are very proud that we've been open this long, and I really attribute it to the people. Our teachers are just a very dedicated folk who have had their higher education degrees, really see this as a profession, which speaks to the longevity of having some staff being here for 30 out of the 40 years. And just there's been so many families who return and their grandchildren will come or their neighbors they refer us to. So we're very proud to be this cornerstone of quality education in the Cooley region.
You also hire dozens of student staff each semester, and they come from a variety of majors to work at the Child Care Center. How do your students enrich the experience at the center?
Sure, that's a great question. I like to say we have a bit of a revolving door. We hire about 60 students to be our assistant teachers each semester, working alongside our professional staff. But we also have folks that come from physical doctor therapy programs. And we have, in the next few weeks, about 80 nutrition students that will come in and watch how we serve meals to the children and how we're teaching those life skills in the smallest moments, right? Having breakfast, lunch. So they really enrich this space by giving it a good perspective and being able to take our story and the great work we do here out into the community and hopefully inspire others to maybe take up this type of work.
Donna, the median hourly wage of Wisconsin childcare workers is $14.52. That's according to U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics data from May of 2024. It's a little less than half of the overall average wage for workers in Wisconsin. How are wages affecting the early childhood profession?
Well, certainly in general, the early childhood profession is one of the professions that simply did not bounce back after COVID as other industries were returning so many of their employees and their staff back into the work. Early childhood just has not bounced back at the same level. That is partly due to that salary. Here at Madison College, the staff are all college employees, which means all of our teachers also have access to college benefits, which certainly is also a factor in the general profession. By the same token, families cannot afford to pay more. Centers have always operated on a razor-thin margin, and that has become increasingly difficult as just the general costs have increased, just the costs of operating, and certainly variables like the cost of liability insurance has been a major factor in the industry itself.
How did you come up with your hourly wage? How did you decide on it?
So our teachers, as a technical college system school, our teachers are all required to have a minimum of a 2-year associate degree.
Many of our teachers have their four-year or their DPI teaching license. About half of my staff right now are graduates of the college early childhood program itself in the past however many years. We started this salary by looking at where other high-quality early care and education environments were, including really looking at where some of the neighboring public schools were for their four-year-old kindergarten rates. So while we may not consistently require the same level of education, our expectations for the work are actually very similar. And so we're able to be supported through the college, again, as college employees with college benefits, and be able to offer our teachers a much higher starting wage. Our teachers all begin at a minimum of $23 an hour, so much higher than that state average.
We are learning about the impact of childcare on higher education campuses as Madison College opens a $10 million early learning campus. We have Donna Jost with us, campus childcare administrator for Madison College, and Ashley Franzo at UW-La Crosse with its campus childcare center. Ashley is the director there. Donna, the center you offer also has a drop-in component now. What impact do you see with drop-in care? What have you noticed?
So the drop-in care is something that our student parent population has been asking for, really thinking about when their regular childcare options fall through and they need to meet with faculty or advising, or they have an exam to take or something along those lines. We are just getting that program started. Again, this center's been open just 1 month. And so we have the space. We now have that space fully equipped and are working on all of the policies and procedures and figuring out exactly how we will operate that program. So ask me that question again, Kate, in a couple of months. Right now, we're just really excited to be able to offer this coming up as soon as we are able to sort of put all of those pieces together. Again, it's something we've been talking about and have never had the space to do it before. And so as part of the planning for this facility, we made sure that space was designated so that we would have that as an option moving forward.
I want to turn to tuition costs, which, Donna, you mentioned can be so hard for families to absorb in their budgets. Madison College bases its tuition rates on household size and income. Is that right?
Household size and income, and also age of the child. And we also offer a part-time schedule. So our part-time schedule has some additional rates in comparison to the full-time schedule. So it's a fairly complicated sliding fee scale.
When do you have to increase your rates? What happens for you to do that?
So we have looked at increasing our rates typically in August of each year prior to the regular academic term. We have tried to keep those increases as absolutely small as we possibly can. Last year, we had to make an increase of 5%. We anticipate another 5% increase in August of this coming year. Of 26. One of the things that we are fortunate enough to have is access to a federal Department of Education grant called CCAMPUS, or Child Care Access Means Parents in School. That helps offset some of the cost of our overhead staff, as well as significantly supporting the cost of care for eligible student parents. That grant will end in 2026, and we are anxiously awaiting to see what Department of Ed will do in the future.
So you're in limbo on that grant funding. Ashley, how do you base your childcare tuition rates at UW-La Crosse? What factors into it?
There are many pieces. We often look to our other campus child centers and what rates they have. We also survey our local community because we really pride ourselves in being middle of the ground. We don't want to be the highest cost to attend, and we do have UWL backing us, so we have good financial support. So we survey every year, and if we have to raise rates, it's the beginning of each school year in late August.
Is that something you've been doing each year, or what does that look like?
I've been in this position for 2.5 years here at UWL, and each year we made a small increase. I know that previously over the COVID years, there were no increases, and for quite some time, we have not raised students' rates, student parents. We do have a scale depending on how you're enrolled, if you're a student or a faculty, staff, or an alumni, and that subgroup, the students, we haven't raised in quite some time.
Donna, I want to turn to graduation. Do campus childcare centers have an impact on graduation rates? What have you seen at Madison College?
We certainly have seen a steady increase in the graduation and or transfer to a four-year institution for our student families who have participated in childcare on campus. We have been offering that campus-based childcare in our primary campus for, well, since 1989. And so we've had some opportunity to really track and follow some of these families as they've pursued their education and have gone on out into the field as well. Part of that grant that I mentioned, the C Campus grant, also requires us to look at that documentation and graduation rates. And consistently, we have families report that they would not have been able to persist in their education from one semester to the next, and or not be able to graduate. In many cases, families have reported to us, student parents have reported as part of the documentation for that grant, that having campus-based childcare that they could count on and that they knew was going to meet their needs was a key factor in just enrolling in the college and in pursuing adult education in general.
Ashley, what do you see at UW-La Crosse and graduation rates with your students who are parents?
Just in my short time here, I've had a few of our parents who have enrolled under a student status and have graduated even mid-year, where they're able to take on more and graduate sooner. And most of the time, they do attribute it to really having us as the support and knowing that it's easy for them. They're already coming to campus. It doesn't take any extra time out of their study schedule. So I have heard only positive things from our student parents regarding having the care here. And we also enroll them first. So if there's ever an open availability spot, they get it right away.
How do your waiting lists look? Do you have a waiting list, Ashley?
Sure, we do. I think that across early care and education, it's challenging for our families who have infants or toddlers. The way that it is structured with the ratios for children and teachers, it needs to be that way for safety, but it is just challenging. We can only have 8 toddlers here at one time. So I would say that wait list is certainly our longest.
How does that look, Donna, at Madison College, especially for infants and toddlers?
So here at the college, we've only been offering infant and toddler care since January of 2021. And during that time, in these last 5 years since we opened those classrooms, our wait list has consistently been pretty significant for that infant and toddler care. the other early learning campus at the Truax facility or the Truax campus is licensed for 85 children. I typically have between 80 and 90 children on the wait list there on any given day.
Wow. What is it like to make that phone call and say to a parent, would you like a spot?
They are so relieved. They are so excited. And it really feels like a gift to be able to offer them, to be able to get them enrolled in the center so that they can either start or continue their schooling. We see our programming as too generational. We recognize that our primary role is supporting the growth and development of their children, but those children do not exist within a vacuum. So by supporting those children, we're also supporting those families so that they can concentrate on their schooling and then graduate, like I said, or transfer to be able to support their families with family sustaining wages with their new degrees.
Well, Donna and Ashley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Yeah, thank you.
Donna Jost is campus child care administrator for Madison College, and Ashley Franzo directs the Campus Child Center at UW-La Crosse. We've been discussing child care needs on higher education campuses after Madison College recently opened a $10 million early learning campus facility, and UW-La Crosse is celebrating 40 years of its center this year.
Coming up, a Wisconsin writer dropped out of high school at age 16. Decades later, he shares his new book of poems and essays and what writing it meant to him.
This helped me to be able to just live and survive and to really find out about myself, I guess.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As a young student, Sherman Funmaker never saw himself as a writer, much less a poet. His dream was to become a rock and roll drummer.
He attended school near Wisconsin Dells and dropped out when he was 16 to pursue that dream, first in Madison, then in California.
Later, he returned to Wisconsin and at age 50 enrolled in college at UW-Baraboo, where he got a degree in English.
These days, writing is a big part of his life and identity, and he travels the state teaching workshops on storytelling.
Now, he's revisiting his own life story in a new memoir filled with poetry and reflections.
Sherman Funmaker is a Ho-Chunk poet and storyteller from Wisconsin Dells. His new book is called Bear Tracks, Memories of a Ho-Chunk Elder, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. Sherman, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, at one point in Bear Tracks, you say you don't necessarily remember a ton about your childhood, but there's enough to fuel a lot of the poems and get a taste of your experience growing up in the 50s and 60s. How did the process of writing these works and putting together this book help you dig into those memories?
Well, first let me say that I didn't start writing until I was like 52. I went to university. And while I was there, I took a creative writing class. And during that time, well, before that, I had never really written anything. You know, maybe a couple of letters to my folks while I was away. But I wasn't ever thinking about writing. But during those university years when I had to hand stuff in, I just started writing. And I had no idea how to write a story. I didn't think I had any stories in me, you know, at that time. I thought, how am I going to do this? But when I started doing it, it just started coming out. I just, you know, once I got into my head, like, okay, I can remember the story about me and my cousin Joe, or I can remember stories about me and my mom and dad driving, you know, to powwows or whatever that was, you know. So it helped me go back once I started writing because I had to put something on paper.
This is one of the things I love about the book. You got that late start in writing. You weren't into school. You dropped out at 16. No. We'll talk about that in a little bit. If I went back and told 16-year-old Sherman, hey, you're going to be a writer, right? And it's going to be super important in your life. That would have been a big shock to that young guy, right?
That would have been like, you're crazy, man. I can barely write. You know, I dropped out of school, and even in grade school, I missed so much. I skipped so much school, it wasn't even funny, you know. So, yeah, at that time, and even 20 years ago when I started writing, a lot of these are like 20, 25 years old. Mm-hmm. And so even then, I'd never dreamed like, oh, this will be a book. You know, like I never thought about that at all. I didn't think of anything. I don't have kids. And so I was wondering, too, as a matter of fact, you know, having all this writing, because I've done poetry and haikus, short stories. I'd wrote a screenplay, you know, a treatment for a film and a play, a short play. Like, what am I going to do with all this? So before the Wisconsin State Historical Society hooked up with me, I thought, I'm just going to have to self-publish because I need this to, you know, I want this not to be sitting in some pile of papers, but I want it to be in something, you know, that I could hand out. So then the Historical Society comes along and they go, hey, we really like your stuff. We could do a book for you. So I'm like, yeah, that'd be cool. Like, okay, let's do a book.
And you mentioned at some point in the book, writing, at least at some points, has been therapeutic for you.
I think at the time when I started writing was that I was going through a divorce and I was going through this and that and life stuff and money stuff and, you know, just life things, you know. And when I started writing, I found out pretty quick that, you know, I could tell you a story in one page, uh-huh. You know. And once I started doing that, then I was like, okay, I got that out into the into the universe. So I got that down on paper. I got it down. I printed it out. Okay, it's out there. So to me, that just started to be more therapy. I didn't feel like talking to somebody about paying somebody $100 an hour so they can, where I could just, you know, where I could just blast out a short story or something. So that's how it became therapy for me.
Now you've got a copy of your book here. People might hear you paging through it as you talk, and it's fine. But that makes me think, though, what was it like for you the first time? Okay, you did this book. Historical Society says, yeah, we'll publish it. The first time you held that book in your hands, like you're doing right now.
Oh, my gosh. It's beyond my wildest imagination. I never thought, never. And when I got the first one in the mail, I literally cried. I really did. I'm just like, oh, my gosh, I'm holding this thing, and I don't have to self-publish, you know. Uh-huh. I can hand this out, you know. I can read from this, but yeah, I was overwhelmed because, like I said, having, you know, as a high school dropout, never wrote anything. I didn't know I was like an okay writer because I feel like that's kind of, you know, a lot of these are just kind of like, to me, I'm just like, well, that's not my best stuff, you know. But but what it was that it was, you know, it's a lot of emotion involved in that, and that's why I think. That's why people who have read it now in the past 2 weeks or so is like they're just very – it's like – it's almost like a diary or a journal. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, we get the humor. We get this and that. We get all these, you know, love stories or stories about life growing up, you know, native in Wisconsin. So that's what it was. It was just like a really nice journey.
I want to go back and meet the 16-year-old Sherman. You drop out of high school, like you said. You were going to live the dream. You came to first Madison, then California to play rock and roll. Yeah. What led you there?
Well, I started playing music when I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, here are the Beatles. Bring them on.
So I was like 12 years old, 11, 12 years old at the time. And I was always like a music guy. I was always, you know, I could remember lyrics and I could sing and, you know, and so when I saw them, I was like, yeah, that's what I want to do. I didn't care. You know, I was kind of an athlete and I wasn't good in school. So that was like my thing was like, okay, now I have something that I can really sink my teeth into. So I started playing then. Soon after, we got a little crappy. Back then, there were garage bands. Called them garage bands.
Sure.
And they all sucked, you know, and we sucked too.
I played in a garage band when I was 16, and
yeah.
You know what?
Yeah.
We sucked.
Yeah. Everybody. But it was fun. It was like I'm not going to make money doing this. You know, I'm not the best drummer, and I won't ever be the best drummer or singer or anything. But I just, like, I had to do it. It was just like a part of, like, this is, you know, this is what makes me feel good. This is what makes gives me joy. And so that started the whole music thing. And then everything was going on in California. So when I was 19, my buddy Steve and I hitchhiked from Austin, Wisconsin, to L.A. So, yeah, cool journey. I don't remember it all. I mean, I wish I could remember. I mean, I don't remember, like, the whole thing. I just remember getting off in L.A., and it was smog, and I thought it was rain. I thought it was cloudy and rainy. Like, no, that's smog.
We're talking to Sherman Funmaker about his new book. It's called Bear Tracks, Memories of a Ho-Chunk Elder. All right, I hit the word elder hard, right? Because you're looking back on this, right? And through the benefit of the years of experience. But in your poems, and even in some of your essays in there, I still hear the 16-year-old kid in there. You're the same guy in a lot of ways. I don't know. How do you juggle being an elder and a young rock and roller all in the same person?
You know, I think that when I was writing these, it was easy for me to go back because to me that was like a really, it was such a good time for me. You know, I was with my family. I'm one of 11 kids, so my mom and dad, they worked hard. They did what they could to keep us straight and keep us on the straight and narrow as much as possible. But, you know, just going back, it's always easy for me to go back and write about, you know, my cousins, my mom and dad, my grandmother, Mountain Wolf Woman, mm-hmm. my grandfather. And so even now, I mean, I'm 73 and I don't feel 73. You know, I really don't. I feel like 25, except for my body, you know, like, aches and pains and, you know, my eyeballs are going. So, but other than that, you know, I still feel pretty young.
Hey, you just mentioned your family, Mountain Wolf Woman, who's legendary autobiographer out there, your grandmother. What does it mean to you to share her story and the stories of your relationship with your parents and siblings and others in these poems? You're not sharing their whole biography, but you're capturing part of what they meant in your life.
Yeah. It just means the world to me that, you know, every day, you know, I just feel blessed. You know, I just feel like I'm glad I'm alive. I'm glad that, you know, I have my siblings and these memories of my mom and dad. And I do remember Stella Stacy was Mountain Wolf Woman. That was my mom's mom. And so I do remember her little house in Black River Falls. And I do remember some stuff, not everything. But just that whole, like, homey, I don't know how to describe it. It's just like, you know, I'm home here in Wisconsin. You know, I got to travel. I got to live in L.A. and live in New York and lived all over the country. But it's like when I came back here, and it was like, okay, this is where I should be. For now.
You write some about, you know, stereotypes and expectations in your life beyond, you know, your Native American guy from Wisconsin, rock and roll drummer inspired by the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show at the same time. You've got a poem called The Indian Poem. Starts up, they want me to engine it up to speak of the earth and moon. I mean, you've gotten that a lot in your life. Hey, man, do Indian stuff.
Being Native, you find, you know, you run into people who... How do I say this? You know, like they like the Native life and the Native idea of living or whatever
the vibe
that is.
Or something, yeah.
And so when I was in school, I thought, 25 years ago, I thought, I'm not going to write about the moon and the sky and the stars. And, you know, first of all, that's not me. Mm. You know, I'm not that type of I'm not a medicine man. I'm not a, you know what I mean? I'm just like a regular guy that happened to write a bunch of stuff down on paper. And now it's in a book.
But on the other hand, you start looking into these things, and Bear Tracks is the title of the book, referring to your Bear Clan identity. You've dug into that some. Maybe it's, you know, you're not exactly what people want in the Indian poem there, but it's part of you too, yeah?
And that's a part, I think, too, a part of the humor. A lot of the stuff is kind of funny, and I wanted it that way because I don't want to be like a serious, everything's serious, and, you know, I was poor and I was this, you know? I wanted to like, that's just how I started writing. And once I got into that, like the whole writing groove, then that's what I wanted to talk about was, you know, yes, this is who I am. And I'm proud to be a Ho-Chunk tribal elder. And I'm proud to be one of the grandsons of Mountain Wolf Woman, but also my parents and the whole community that I live in. You know, they've all supported me, and I love them for that.
All right, another shock for young 16-year-old Sherman. Not only do you write and gotten into writing, you're doing workshops about storytelling, right, for students and people of all ages. What kind of advice do you have for them? They're not going to share exactly the stories you share, obviously, or the way you share them. How do you encourage them to tell stories the way that's right for them?
Well, in 2007, I went to University of New Mexico for a year, and I studied the arts and acting, and that was terrible. But when I came back in a couple of years, you know, I started mentoring the Ho-Chunk kids. And so we did video stuff, and we did, but it's just fun to, that's kind of got me started on the whole mentoring. And then once I figured out that this was therapy for me, then that's kind of what I wanted to focus on, was that for me, this helped me. This helped me to be able to just live and survive and to really, really find out about myself, I guess, is that, you know. And so when I talk to people, I always get them to, like, you need, you know, everybody has a story. I never thought 25 years ago that, no, never, ever, ever. But I said, everybody has a story, and they do. I'm just trying to encourage them to, like, you know, find out what it is that, you know, put it on paper so it's here, you know, it's somewhere so that people can, you know, can look at that or can read it and to kind of take a look inside your life. So that's what I do. I just try to encourage them to just write. Even if you're writing a letter to your mom and dad, just write. So they'll have some. That's why we keep birthday cards and Christmas cards, is because somebody took the time to put something on there and write their name. So
I got to ask before I let you go, do you ever sit down at the drums anymore?
I do have a part of a drum set at my house, and I used to be really pretty good, I thought. I used to practice before going to California. I used to practice probably every day after high school, you know, and I'd practice in this crappy band. We'd practice together, but, you know, I wanted to be the best that I could be. I never thought I'm going to be the best drummer. No, never. But I want to be the best that I could be. And so I put in hours and hours. And you know, the cool thing about that was one day I thought about that, and looking back, and I thought, you know, my mom and dad never, ever said anything about being loud. Never, ever said quiet or, you know, never. And I didn't even think about that till, honestly, it's like years and years later. And they were so supportive. And you know, my mom, by hook and by crook, she got me, you know, my drums and whatever I needed. They were my roadies, you know. We'd play in these stupid little bar bands, we called them back, you know, when I was a kid. And mom and dad would show up and they'd be there watching and listening. So, yeah, it was pretty, pretty cool. They were pretty cool.
Sherman, thanks so much for sharing your stories with us.
Thank you.
That was writer and storyteller Sherman Funmaker talking about his new memoir from Wisconsin Historical Society Press. It's called Bear Tracks, Memories of a Ho-Chunk Elder. Sherman's doing a book launch at the Village Booksmith in Baraboo tomorrow at 7 p.m. It is free and open to the public. Hey, Kate, are you pretty good at spelling stuff?
I'm just average. How about you?
I'm generally pretty good, and I'm going to a spelling bee tonight. WPR is hosting a series of spelling bees around the state. I'm emceeing the one today at the Lakely in Eau Claire.
You can find info about our spelling bees and more at WPR.org/events. Rob, you're hosting, but you're not competing. Would you win if you did?
I'm going to say probably not. I always think, you've heard this story, I always think back to an elementary school spelling bee. My dad worked in Taylor, Michigan at the time, Taylor. In the spelling bee, I got the word Taylor with an I instead of a Y. So I was out.
Do you have a spelling bee story or memory to share? Tell us about it. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can call or text to get in touch. That number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook, Royce Podeswa, and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.